one of the most ubiquitous technologies, the doorbell, has not changed since it was invented in 1880 until now. Introducing the DoorBot, the first ever video doorbell built for the smartphone. With DoorBot, you can see and speak with visitors from anywhere. But I didn't invent DoorBot just to make our lives more convenient. It also adds needed security. Think of it as caller ID for your front door.
Jamie Siminoff pitching his invention on the reality show Shark Tank 5 years ago. He asked the Sharks for a $700,000 investment in his struggling startup, DoorBot. They declined. Well, DoorBot is now Ring, and Amazon just agreed to buy it for $1 billion. We'll talk about what that means coming up. But first, just when you thought you'd gotten over the 2016 election, the 2020 campaign is already underway. This week, President Trump announced his campaign manager. It's Brad Parscale, the guy who ran Trump's digital media operations in the last campaign. And that means a lot of Facebook and Twitter posts targeting certain groups. And that means he's attracted the attention of congressional investigators and special counsel Robert Mueller as they look into Russian meddling in the 2016 election. Joining us to tell us more about Parscale and what his elevation to campaign manager tells us about what to expect in the next election is Joshua Green. He's a correspondent for Bloomberg Businessweek and author of the book Devil's Bargain, Steve Bannon, Donald Trump, and the Storming of the Presidency. Hi.
It's good to be with you.
Well, you sat down to interview Parscale weeks before the 2016 election. What is he like, and what did the campaign's digital strategy look like under him?
Well, he's a striking guy. He's 6'8", 240-pound, giant beard. He looks like an MMA wrestler. So very intimidating-looking figure, but fairly friendly guy. And, you know, I've been pushing throughout the campaign to let the Trump folks open up and show me what they were doing digitally. It was clear pretty early on that with all that was happening on Facebook and Twitter that this is an area of concentration for the Trump campaign. So about 2 weeks before Election Day, they finally said, okay, come on down to San Antonio where their digital operation is housed. And Parscale and his team at Cambridge Analytica basically gave me and my colleague Sasha Eisenberg a run through of everything they were doing in real time.
And what did that look like?
Well, a lot of it was based on Facebook, which won't come as any surprise. I mean, Trump and the people in this campaign were convinced that Facebook was instrumental to their candidacy. If you flash back to 3 weeks before the election, the broad expectation was that Trump was going to lose and that all this Facebook effort was geared toward building up a massive audience that could, you know, after the election, form the basis for a Trump TV network or something like that. But what they were really doing was going out through Facebook, using Facebook's tools to find people who are likely Trump voters, to activate them, get them excited about Trump, get them to give money, to buy MAGA hats, and get them involved in the campaign.
Hmm. So all that sounds like just regular campaign strategy online. How is it attracting the attention of people who think, well, what could possibly be the connection between that and Russia and all the hijinks Russia was up to using Facebook?
Well, we've discovered since the election that Russia ran a lot of ads intended to be divisive, run on behalf of the Trump campaign or in order to get people to either support Donald Trump or turn against Hillary Clinton. I've seen some of these ads, and they mirror the same sorts of themes that the Trump campaign was running in some of its Facebook ads, including what are called Facebook dark posts, which are ads that can be directed at specific groups of people that other people can't see. So Parscale showed me, for instance, a Facebook dark post the campaign was running at African Americans in Florida that was built around an animation of Hillary Clinton calling black males super predators. And the point of this ad was to discourage these potential black voters from showing up to the polls and pulling the lever for Hillary. Well, if you look at what the Russians were doing, they seem to have a similar aim in mind of sowing, you know, discord and depressing Clinton's vote. And they acted in a lot of the same swing states that the Trump campaign was active in. So that has convinced some liberals and Democrats that there must have been collusion going on. The House Intelligence Committee has begun looking into this. They had Parscale testify at a closed-door hearing last October. Robert Mueller, the special counsel, his investigators are known to be looking into this. But so far, no facts have emerged to prove that there was any kind of online collusion. But it's certainly something that bears watching.
So is Trump taking a risk here, naming him as campaign chairman when I don't know, down the line, he could not only be subpoenaed, but could be indicted.
Yeah, I suppose there's a small risk. I mean, but Trump himself is also the one under investigation by the special counsel, and pretty much everyone in his inner circle. Parscale, as far as I know, has no real reason to worry. I wouldn't assume that he's any more guilty than anybody else in the Trump circle of having done anything wrong. Certainly nobody has charged that. Nothing has been proven. And one thing we know about Trump is that he really cares a lot about his online following in Facebook and Twitter. It's something he talks about a lot. When I was down in San Antonio, Parscale told me that when he and Trump were flying between events, Trump used to like him to open up his laptop and kind of show him measurements and metrics of, you know, how many people were retweeting him and how many people were following him on Facebook. And look, it's something that worked for the Trump campaign. I mean, they won a campaign that nobody expected them to win, in part because they were able to activate their followers this way. So it stands to reason that this is going to continue to be a focus. It's going to be a focus in 2020. And if you're Donald Trump and you've burned through a series of campaign managers and you've got a guy like Brad Parscale, who you know and trust and is expert in this technology, why not put him in charge of the campaign?
Well, how does he compare to those other campaign managers? Because they certainly were larger-than-life figures, kind of hot names. You've got Corey Lewandowski, Paul Manafort, Steve Bannon. Paul Manafort is facing trial in September for money laundering charges. Steve Bannon now persona non grata after spilling it all to Michael Wolff for that book, Fire and Fury. And, well, Corey Lewandowski is out as well. So in terms of kind of personality, big personality and possible controversy trailing him, how does he compare?
Well, I did a piece in Business Week yesterday essentially listing the three reasons why I thought Parscale was named. Number one, obviously the digital first. He's an expert in that. Number two is loyalty. You know, when we were down there, I got him talking about his relationship with Trump. And he started out actually as a freelance website developer and built the website for the Trump Winery in Virginia and kind of worked his way up. Deeply loyal to Trump and to the Trump family. He told me, when Trump says jump, I say how high? And then I give him my opinion of where I should jump to. The other issue, I think, is that Parscale is very discreet in a way that Trump campaign managers tend not to be. Remember, Corey Lewandowski got in trouble for grabbing a female reporter. Charged with assault. That was later dropped. Manafort obviously has big problems. Steve Bannon, often seemed to make the campaign more about him than about Trump. That's never going to be a problem with Brad Parscale.
Hmm. Okay, so meanwhile, Mike Rogers, the head of the NSA, is saying that he hasn't been given any orders to try to combat Russian attempts to interfere in the upcoming elections.
That's right. And this is obviously a sore spot with Trump and his administration. Trump seems to view any attempt to police Russian interference as a way of undermining the legitimacy of this presidential victory. And there aren't a lot of people in the Trump administration willing to sound the alarm on this.
Joshua Green, correspondent for Bloomberg Businessweek. He's author of the book Devil's Bargain, Steve Bannon, Donald Trump, and the Storming of the Presidency. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, as the next election is expected to be a social media election, our homes are getting ready. They are increasingly wired to the internet. Amazon yesterday bought the Santa Monica-based company Ring for $1 billion. Maybe you've never heard of Ring. I hadn't. But Ring makes high-tech doorbells. So when someone comes to your home, you can see who it is on your smartphone or your computer. Ring's founder, Jamie Siminoff, pitched the idea on Shark Tank 5 years ago, but judges didn't bite.
It's really not an internet play. It's a consumer device.
I just don't think it's for me.
This company, instead of being worth $7 million, could be worth $80 million, $90 million. I just don't see that progression. And for that reason, I'm out.
Well, Jeff Bezos, obviously, he's in. What does it mean for Amazon's empire and for us, for consumer privacy? April Glazer writes about technology for Slate. Hi, April.
Hi.
Okay, so 2 million people use Ring right now. That's not an insubstantial number. How did it become so popular?
A lot of people are ordering things online, right? And as more people order things online, they're getting stuff delivered to their homes. And that has increased the need for folks to maybe have a camera in the front of their home at their doorstep to see when a package gets dropped or ostensibly stolen. And so, you know, as more things are being delivered and more things are being bought online, the market for smart doorbells has also gone up.
Okay. And does it work?
You know, they must because people keep buying them. And it's not just Ring. There's also Nest, which is a company spun off from Alphabet or Google, rather. You know, people seem to like it. They seem to like to be able to look on their smartphone and see, you know, a camera image of their front porch or their back porch and see that the package has been dropped or hidden behind the bushes or, you know, what have you, and know that it hasn't been stolen.
Okay, so Amazon is famously in the delivery of packages business and has also bought Whole Foods and has Alexa. What does this do for Amazon? What's the grand plan?
Amazon is not just a book website anymore, a website where you can buy books. It's just vertically expanding rapidly. When I say vertically expanding, I mean they just keep adding, you know, new types of businesses to their portfolio. So now they're also a grocer, and now they're in the smart home business. But they're really a logistics company more than anything, because even with their acquisition of Whole Foods, they want to deliver that food to your door, and they're delivering stuff that you order online to your door. And so this actually fits really nicely into their kind of logistics empire, because as they deliver more stuff to your door, as I said, stuff gets stolen, and now they're also in the smart door business. So now they're kind of also selling you the doorbell that they use to get stuff into your house.
And don't they also want to be able to actually get inside your house, literally, like have the people deliver inside your house?
Yes. Last fall, they started a program called Amazon Key, which is available to Amazon customers who have bought and installed kind of Amazon's own cloud cam security camera. And now ostensibly this might eventually work with the Ring camera, but that hasn't been announced yet. But if you're one of those customers that has a kind of an in-home delivery or that opts for the Key program, then an Amazon courier can authenticate themselves with the camera, unlock the door, enter your home, and leave the package. There have been some security problems with this, but overall, it seems like it hasn't made too many negative headlines.
Okay, so am I in the minority by feeling a little creeped out by all of this?
Not at all. I mean, here's the thing. When we invite more mega companies into our homes with cameras and, you know, that are storing the camera feed on a cloud somewhere or are, you know, listening to what we're saying because they have smart speakers that are activated when we call on them, it's totally makes sense to have some reservation about where all that data is going. Can it be subpoenaed by law enforcement? You know, is it going to be used to market to me? Are the things that I'm saying or doing, you know, hopefully not being watched doing so at home, going to be used to send ads to me? And it's certainly a new way of living with companies that we're not used to. So it makes sense to have some reservations.
Yeah. Okay. So meanwhile, is there any kind of, I don't know, any kind of legislation or any kind of regulation on this in terms of your privacy and what Amazon can do with all of this information?
Amazon is supposed to disclose what they do in their consumer policy and their privacy policies. And if they go against those privacy policies, then they would be, you know, in breach of kind of consumer protection laws. There are not kind of hardcore rules or regulations about, you know, the security of smart home devices, but they have to abide by the consumer protection standards that they lay out. That said, as more people, as I mentioned, are bringing cameras and speakers into their homes, there might be a push for some sort of blanket regulation over these devices.
But that hasn't happened yet.
Not at the moment.
April Glazer writes about tech for Slate. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, the opioid crisis in Appalachia and the first responders who face it every day.
2 months, 27 overdoses.
That's just us.
That's just me, my call.
The filmmaker behind the Oscar-nominated film Heroin, with an E on the end, next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It's estimated that one American dies from an opioid overdose every 15 minutes. It's the leading cause of death for Americans under the age of 50. By any measure, we are in an epidemic on the scale of the AIDS crisis at its peak or a full-blown war. Congress is considering a $1 billion-a-year measure to increase treatment. It would also limit pill supplies to 3 days for most people. We're going to talk about the scale and scope of the crisis with the writer Andrew Sullivan in a few minutes. But first, it can be hard to see the damage of opioids if it's not happening in your own community in front of you. Elaine McMillian Sheldon is a documentary filmmaker from West Virginia, and she wanted to take a different approach to covering this story. She followed three women who are fighting overdoses in their town of Huntington, West Virginia. Her film Heroin is nominated for an Oscar for Best Short Documentary, and Elaine McMillian Sheldon joins us now. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Well, you're from West Virginia, so you have seen this up close. And what does it look like to you?
It's changed a lot. I mean, you know, I'm 30 years old now, and I've lost a number of classmates from my cheerleading squad in middle school to my graduating class in high school. And it looks like something, you know, I think Americans don't understand addiction. We think that, you know, some of us are exempt from it. We've pushed addiction off to the side, maybe as a lower class issue, or have racialized it. But certainly this has brought it to everyone's attention and has hit, I think, a certain class in America that has avoided a lot of the other, you know, quote unquote, war on drugs that we've experienced.
Right. I think a lot of white people
are
addicts. And when you say cheerleaders, you don't normally think of cheerleaders as junkies.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, it's, you know, it's a pill. It's prescribed by a doctor when you have an injury. And oftentimes, there were deceitful marketing campaigns in the beginning with OxyContin and those drugs. And so it just created a perfect storm for, you know, once the DEA shut those down, you had a huge population that was addicted.
And so they turned to heroin.
Yes.
And now fentanyl.
Now carfentanil.
And fentanyl, just to put it into context, is, I've read, 50 times stronger than heroin.
Yeah. Yeah.
And just a tiny speck of it could kill you.
Absolutely. I mean, coming in contact with it, there's been police that have overdosed coming in contact with it. So, yeah, it's extremely dangerous. And carfentanil is elephant tranquilizer. So, yeah.
Wow. And okay, so you profile three women who are trying to find some kind of way out of this. And why did you choose these three women?
Well, my husband and I, we made this film together. We went to Huntington because Huntington had been very transparent about their overdose numbers. They actually have an app that gives real-time data on overdoses. And they're just, they let the media in a big way because they needed help. And they needed to tell the story of what was happening there in hopes that they could get some more support. And so we went there to try to better understand that, because we were seeing so much negativity and direness come out of Huntington. And we're like, certainly there's got to be something else going on. And we met Jan Rader, who's the first female fire chief in West Virginia's history, and just started from there.
And she spends her whole day doing this,
yeah,
right?
I mean, you're right. Yeah, I mean, she's, you know, when we first started filming, she was the shift commander, and now she's the fire chief, and her role's changed quite a bit, but she still goes on overdose calls, you know, all day. Every day.
So every day she's dealing with how many overdoses?
I think it's 9% of the time that her men get on a fire truck, they're actually going to a fire. And so the Huntington Fire Department has become the first responder because they are located in so many parts of the city that can get there quicker than the county EMS. And so it's 5 to 7 average overdoses a day. August 2016, they had 28 overdoses in one day. Amazingly, no one died. That's just how good these first responders are. This is how it's become clockwork to them. You know, it's their job to go out and save these people, and they themselves are struggling with, are they helping? You know, they're seeing the same person overdose over and over, and there's a lot of compassion fatigue. And, you know, Jan's role is really just keep up the empathy within the department.
Compassion fatigue by whom?
The first responders.
She herself and her men.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I think first responders and the medical community and America's, you know, society at large has not treated those suffering from addiction well in the past. We've seen them as moral failures who don't deserve a second chance, rather than seeing this as a health crisis.
Let's play a clip of tape of Jan Rader. Here she is talking about what she's seen in West Virginia, and some other firefighters talking about what they've seen.
22 years ago when I started my career, it was probably 10 years before I saw a large number of deaths. And now the kids that are starting today are seeing 30, 40 dead bodies in a year. And they're not just dead bodies, they're young people. It's okay for me to see that number of dead bodies. I'm an older lady at the end of my career. It's got to affect them.
So 2 months, 27 overdoses?
That's just us.
That's just me, my call.
So how do they deal with this psychologically? I mean, do they have PTSD? They must.
I mean, I think that anytime you're in, you know, it's a very stressful job. I mean, just filming their job is stressful. I don't have a bone in my body that could see and do what they do. I mean, it was looking at them and filming what they do was what kept me calm and able for me to even do what I was doing, to be there and film. And so, yeah, they see a lot of really awful things. You know, they watch children watching their parents overdose and die, and they see things that, you know, a lot of people just couldn't handle seeing. And so they have to have a way to blow off steam as well.
Okay, so they carry around naloxone, right? This drug that revives people and, you know, stops an overdose. And what is the reaction once someone who has overdosed comes out of it? Are they grateful?
It's like they just took a power nap. I mean, they wake up clear.
And not high at all.
No, it throws them right into withdrawals. So they're often very sick when they wake up. I mean, they're drowsy a little bit, but they wake up and they're often confused about where they are. It's, you know, they themselves, it's not a positive experience for anyone. So it's not a teachable moment. Jan talks about why the quick response team, which is this team that goes out 24 hours or 48 hours after the overdose back to that home to talk to the person about getting into rehab, is so important, because at the time of an overdose, it's very negative. You know, the person is shamed. They feel shamed and they're embarrassed. Oftentimes they're mad because you've thrown them into withdrawal and now they're dope sick. It's kind of crazy. I love West Virginia. I love my home state. And I'm sure, you know, people from West Virginia don't want me saying that on the radio, but it's frightening. I mean, it's actually, you're really concerned for these people, because you know as soon as they get dope sick, they're going to do what they need to do to keep staying high. And a lot of people that are using don't want to be using. You know, they're miserable. That a lot of people, we followed four guys in recovery for a separate film, and, you know, they just talk about how worthless they felt and how miserable they felt and how they couldn't get out of that cycle, because, you know, Huntington, 5 to 7 overdoses a day, but less than 10 detox beds in the entire county. A rehab won't take you unless you've detoxed. And so there's a huge bottleneck to even getting people into rehab, let alone there's 3 months long waiting lists for rehab. People are overdosing, waiting to get into rehab. One of the guys in the film, he was going to rehab 2 days later. He overdosed on Wednesday when we filmed him, and he was going into rehab Friday. So it's, I mean, time is ticking and these people's lives are on the line.
So there's not enough rehab. And according to Jan, there's not enough naloxone and Narcan to immediately revive people who are overdosing.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So the reason is, you know, A, how can cities like Huntington, which aren't economically, you know, super well off, how can they even afford to distribute and use this naloxone?
Is it expensive?
It is expensive. I don't know the price right off the top of my head. It changes quite a bit. But there's two different types. There's Narcan and naloxone. And then there's the auto injector, which is does the 5-3-2-1 countdown that you hear in the film. Those are way overpriced. They're made by a pharmaceutical company called Kalia. I think Narcan in just the nasal form you can get for under $100 at this point. But it's still very expensive.
But naloxone is over $100 a dose.
Oh, yeah.
So I could see how that would add up. And who's paying for that?
I mean, right now it's grants and donations. But no, I mean, the health department could not just buy it outright. They have no way to buy that. But that's the minimum of what needs to be done. That's only just to keep people alive. I mean, that's just a fix for today.
Hmm.
I just wish people would wake up faster to this, because we've got a generation behind this current generation that's growing up without parents. And it's sad, because, you know, I'm here in LA and there's certainly an opioid problem in California as well. But I think that until you live on my street and you see the people I see every day and you know you feel helpless, you can't help them. And until you don't have naloxone and you see someone overdosing and you can't help them, you yourself may not quite understand why it's so important that every community member has this.
Why do you think there isn't a greater sense of urgency on the part of, you know, Washington lawmakers, for example, or, you know, thought leaders in the rest of the country? Why is it seen just as a problem in West Virginia or in Ohio or in New Hampshire?
I don't know. I don't know that I have an answer for that. I mean, I think that addiction is surrounded by stigma, and people don't want to talk about addiction. People don't understand addiction. And there's a lot, there's still a lot of misunderstanding about what these drugs do to your brain. And so I don't know. I mean, I think we have to totally reconfigure how we treat people suffering from substance use disorder and how we treat the war on drugs. I mean, these 4 out of 5 heroin users start with a pill that's legal. So, you know, the DEA every year sets quotas for pharmaceutical companies that allows them to distribute a certain amount of pills, no matter what type of pills they make. And the DEA keeps rising quotas for opiates. So we could limit them from the federal level if we wanted to. But yeah, I don't know. I don't get it. I honestly don't. I don't understand what it's going to take if it's more than 100 people dying every single day in communities all across the country, not just in Appalachia. I don't know.
I mean, it's got to get to the level of an AIDS crisis where everyone knows someone.
It's beyond it passed the death rate.
Right.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's a lot of things happening in America, right? Like, we have a lot of problems. So it's certainly one of the many challenges that we're looking at. And I think a lot of people feel helpless in it. You know, when you look at these statistics from far away, it's overwhelming. But there's these women and men all across the country, just like these three women in our film, that don't have the support they need. And those are the people we need to focus our energy on supporting. And they make me feel hopeful. So
there's Jan. Tell us about the other two women.
Yeah. So the film focuses on Jan Rader, Nisha Freeman, and Patricia Keller. Patricia Keller is the family court judge in Cabell County, but she oversees drug court, which is actually a volunteer position. Drug court is a rehabilitative style court's criminal justice system where, you know, people who commit a crime associated with their drug use can go through a 1 to 2 year supervised program through drug court. And then Nisha Freeman is a real estate agent and a single mom who takes upon herself to go out every Wednesday night and help women that are trapped in prostitution due to their drug use either get food or a safe shelter for that night. She counsels them once they're in prison, helps them get into rehab. She pretty much gives them everything she can because she's taken this upon herself that this, you know, this is the ministry that she chooses to do, and she does it in a very non-judgmental way. You know, she thinks that this is the work Christians should be doing, is helping those in need. So yeah, that's her calling. And we all could be a Nisha Freeman. I think, like, Jan Rader is a very heroic fire chief, you know, and Judge Keller is a judge, you know, but Nisha Freeman represents what all Americans really can do, which is looking around your community. Who needs your help? Who is being neglected within your community that needs your help? And she found a way to do it. And it was through giving them a lunch to begin with. And now it's become bigger.
So the Oscars are this Sunday. Are you bringing Jan?
All three of the women are coming. Jan Rader, Nisha Freeman, and Patricia Keller. We're all going together. I'm excited. So excited. They had their dresses before I had mine. They were more ready than I was.
Ready to go.
Yeah, we're all really excited.
That's good. Well, no, thank you so much for coming in today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That's Elaine McMillian Sheldon. She's the director of the Oscar-nominated short film, Heroin. Coming up, the big picture when it comes to opioid addiction. Why are 2 million Americans hooked?
I think it's important to understand that opioids are not just about physical pain, but about psychological pain, about spiritual pain, even existential pain.
Writer Andrew Sullivan explains how the American way of life has created this need to escape. Next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. We're going to talk more now about the opioid crisis facing the country with writer Andrew Sullivan and where the film Heroin paints a ground level portrait of the situation in West Virginia. Sullivan takes a larger and longer view. His latest piece in New York Magazine is called The Poison We Pick, and he's with us on the line now. Hi there.
Hi.
Well, as you write, this is by any measure just a major crisis, and you write that more than 2 million Americans are now hooked on some kind of opioid. Why isn't this receiving the kind of attention it demands?
That's a very good question. I think part of it is tribal. I think that many of the elites on the coast especially regard this as a sort of red state problem. These are the people who vote Trump, after all. Why should we really care? And I think that's one unfortunate aspect of it. The other is that this is a very quiet crisis. This is not like crack, in which violence is spilling out all over the place, affecting everybody else. The thing about people who are succumbing to opioid addiction is that they do it at home, in quiet. This is also something that the middle class is affected by, and many people in the middle class are too ashamed to speak of it, too embarrassed by it. When you find your kid dead in his bedroom at age 17, you don't exactly want to go out and publicize that. So it reminded me in a little bit of AIDS, the way that people looked at it and thought, well, these people kind of had it coming, didn't they? And I think when people die because they are involved in illegal drugs, then people feel like, well, you do that, you suffer the consequences. But it remains, it seems to me, by far the most urgent problem in our national debate.
Right. Well, speaking of AIDS, I mean, there was, of course, the AIDS activist movement that sprung out of that, ACT UP in particular, which really changed the national conversation. And also, as you write in your essay, ushered in this new era of patients' rights, that patients needed to take more control over their health care, but that maybe in a weird way, that has contributed to this opioid epidemic because patients have demanded pain medication.
Yes. In fact, in the mid-90s through the early 2000s, the great and in some ways understandable position was that no one should live with chronic pain since these drugs seem to be able to relieve it. And I think it's important to emphasize that these drugs do, in fact, help a lot of people deal with their lives. The question is why a subsection of those people find it so entrancing, so much better than actual sober living. And I think it's important to understand that opioids are not just about physical pain, but about psychological pain, about spiritual pain, even existential pain. And I think a lot of people, it's interesting the geography here, it tends to be concentrated in places where really modernity and post-industrialization have left millions and millions of people with less and less meaning in their lives and more misery. The jobs they do have less meaning. The religion they used to believe in that gave their lives some direction has disappeared. Technology has taken away the dignity of work. Technology has also encouraged us to disappear into our own worlds via cell phones, smartphones, the internet, video games, in which socialization is less and less common. And, you know, in some ways, what OxyContin does, for example, is that it gives you an instant replacement for our natural occurring oxytocin, which is the kind of happiness and cheerfulness and direction and meaning that comes from social interaction.
And is this a particular, I mean, what you're painting is a picture of post-capitalism crumbling, the idea of the whole capitalist idea as being incredibly unhealthy in many ways, spiritually, psychologically, and also physically.
I mean, that's the truth. Unless you have some real pushback against those forces, which treat us as purely economic agents, as opposed to complicated spiritual, emotional, psychological humans, then our lives will become unbearable. And I think that's what we're discovering. And I do think, and this is controversial, I do think the collapse of a living religion for many people has made this much worse, because religion was a way both to bring people together and to give them meaning through their lives. And that has gone away. And when you hit trouble, or when you're unemployed, or when you're living in a place that has no meaning left, you don't have that recourse anymore. Now, the other thing I want to say is that opium has an ancient history, that this drug, which comes from a flower, has been in America forever. Americans have been infatuated with it from the get-go. It was widely used in the American War of Independence. Jefferson actually grew it at Monticello. In the Civil War, and after the Civil War, there was much more opium addiction in America than there is today. It was much more widespread, partly because it was the only way to counteract the agony of war injuries. The difference, of course, is that that kind of opium didn't kill you. It was restricted scientifically, pharmaceutically, to a drug that wasn't likely to put you in a coma and die. And the way the modern world, especially the 21st century, late 20th century, pharmaceuticals, sophistication, has meant that this stuff has become more and more potent over time, as well as the function of it being prohibited. And so now we have a whole new crisis on top of this, which is fentanyl, which is the most concentrated opioid you can possibly imagine, 50 times as potent as heroin. Fentanyl is now responsible for an increasing number of these overdose deaths. In other words, it's turning what would be a crisis into an emergency. In as much as if 20,000 people last year died of something, we would, what is essentially a poisonous substance, we'd create a national emergency. But the fact that this is happening right now, we're almost indifferent to.
But what you're saying, though, I mean, you're saying is the problem is much greater than that. I mean, it's a spiritual problem, as you said, or a philosophical problem, and really, how do you solve that?
A cultural problem. A cultural problem of late capitalism.
Yeah. So how do you solve that? I mean, it's so immense what you're talking about.
It's really hard. It's really hard. I mean, especially when technology may soon remove work from people's lives, as we've historically understood it. And work and pride in one's work and meaning in one's work is a hugely important factor in one's own well-being. And I think this is especially affecting men, whose economic status has fallen as productive physical labor's value has declined, who are also culturally beset by the rise of women's equality, who don't even have the means to support their own families and wives anymore, who are often disappearing into their own holes of internet addiction or porn addiction. If we do not find a way to regain that, if we do not reinvent our religion or find meaningful ways of engaging in community again, then this is going to get worse, not better. And we see no sign of it getting better. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the thing. Last year, there were more drug overdoses in this country than the peak year of AIDS deaths.
Wow.
But that was the peak year of AIDS deaths before it started to decline. All the evidence suggests it's going to increase. The more I've read about this, the more horrifying it really is.
Yeah.
And the sadness, the lost lives. These are young people.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them, the age of overdose deaths has halved in the last 10 years. So this is a really deep problem in the heart of this country. And I think we can't quite grapple with it because the solutions are really a little bit too nebulous and hard to get than we want.
Yeah. I mean, it's easier almost with AIDS because you know exactly, it means a disease and you treat a disease and and that's something tangible. This is something else.
Yeah, loneliness, isolation, misery. I mean, look, opium is affecting this subpopulation who have particularly been damaged by this kind of economy and this kind of society. But look at the rest of us. Most people are on, a lot of people on antidepressants. There's a reason why cannabis use has soared. There's a desperate need for some kind of relief from the world and economy and society we're living in. And I think this points us to a deeper question, is how do we re-engineer the American social compact, the American economy, and indeed the cultural and spiritual life of America. And you see some responses like, for example, the enormous popularity now of meditation or of yoga. These are attempts to find a way to alleviate the pressures and loneliness of contemporary life. But we need more of it.
Andrew Sullivan, read his latest piece. It's in New York Magazine. It's called The Poison We Pick. Andrew, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, well, one way to relieve existential dread is through art. We'll tell you about a new exhibition of Caribbean art next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The island paradise is the image of the Caribbean you find in travel magazines. But in real life, these island countries are still dealing with the fallout from their colonial past, as well as problems related to things like global warming. A show of Caribbean artists is touching on these themes, and it runs through this weekend at the Museum of Latin American Art in Long Beach. Our frequent art contributor, Carolina Miranda, who writes the Culture High and Low column for the LA Times, is here to tell us all about it. Hello.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. Okay, so the Caribbean is vast, encompassing many different cultures, many different countries. You've got Cuba, you've got Haiti, you've got Jamaica, you've got Barbados, Bahamas, blah, 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 blah. How does one art show encompass all of these different and disparate cultural identities?
Well, that was quite a task that the curator Tatiana Flores had before her. Like, how do you even define the region? Does it include countries such as Belize? And so rather than trying to sort of tell this overall Caribbean 101 story, what she did is she really began to look at what are the common threads that can bind a place like Haiti with a place like Curaçao, with Jamaica, with Puerto Rico. And she began to find these themes related to questions of mapping, like how the Caribbean has been mapped from pre-colonial eras to colonial eras to the present. You know, what do those limits of power represent? Who controls what? Not just in terms of the land, but in the maritime area around it. The Caribbean, if you ever look at a maritime map, it's like chopped up into all of these different zones. And there's an artist in the show who has a piece exactly about that. How artists deal with horizon. A lot of artists in the Caribbean are dealing with the question of the horizon. You know, we see the horizon of the ocean as this peaceable kind of tourist, like, oh, I'm going to lay on that
like
beach.
Turquoise.
Yeah, and I'm going to have a cocktail. But for someone who lives on a small island their entire lives, or maybe has for generations, their families have for generations, the horizon can take on other connotations.
Like hurricanes coming.
Like hurricanes coming, like global warming, issues of environmentalism, which she deals, which the show deals with. And also these kind of ideas of certainly fluidity, because it's water, you know, nothing grows in it, nothing can be planted in it, as the poet Derek Walcott once said. But also the fact that this ocean is a conveyance, but also this thing that surrounds you and overwhelms you at all time and maybe screws up your notions of time while you're at it.
Interesting. Okay, and then talk about one artist in particular in his piece, Dancing, Pouring, Crackling, and Mourning. Great title.
I believe that's the Didier William painting that you were talking about. He is a remarkable artist who's Haitian American, was born in Haiti but raised here and now teaches in Philadelphia. And he does these paintings that kind of look at the black figure in art. And I think for William, one of the really interesting thing about the Caribbean is that it has been this place of a huge site of slavery, but also a very important site of black self-determination with the Haitian Revolution in 1804. That was a slave-led revolt that led to the first free, one of the first free nations in the Western Hemisphere and the first free black nation. And he does these paintings that feature these shadowy figures, many of which have eyes all over their bodies. And they're very beautiful and a little bit disturbing to look at, you know, these figures that you look at and then they gaze back upon you.
Oh, that sounds really good.
Yes, they are beautiful. And they're large, so you're kind of inhaled by the paintings when you go look at them.
And then there's a video called Black Bullets.
Yes, that is a piece by a Danish Trinidadian artist, Jeanette Ellers. And it is this sequence, it's a video on a loop that shows a sequence of black figures descending down a staircase, what appears to be behind an infinity pool. So it's these figures getting lost in this watery horizon. And so when you think about it, it's a beautiful video. I mean, I must have watched that the loop probably like 12 times over. So it's really hypnotic, but it also tells this really incredible story when you think of these are black figures kind of being absorbed by this watery place, when you think about the transatlantic slave trade and the people who died as a result of it and the people who died on the way. A lot of stories about slaves being thrown overboard as part of the slave trade. And then when you think about it in the case of climate change, you know, rising sea change, bigger hurricanes, something that the region is contending with, as we saw with Hurricane Maria, these figures being enveloped by this watery deep takes on a whole other story.
Oh, it's so fascinating. I guess you could look at it as a sort of a different form of colonialism, because a lot of climate change is caused by America and other Western countries.
Industrial nations, exactly.
All right. The show is called Relational Undercurrents, Contemporary Art of the Caribbean Archipelago. It's a mouthful.
Yes, it is.
And it's up just this weekend, right? Through Sunday?
Through Sunday.
At the Museum of Latin American Art in Long Beach. Okay, so let's talk about art fairs for a second. The Frieze Fairs, which runs art fairs in New York and also London, I believe.
Exactly, that's where they're from.
Is going to do one in L.A. now.
They are going to do one in L.A. starting in 2019 at the Paramount Studios.
Where the Paris Photo Show was,
Where the Paris Photo Show was, and I believe FIAC was held there, too. Mm-hmm. And this represents Frieze's first big LA event. The big news with them is that a year or two ago, the Hollywood talent agency Endeavor bought a stake in Frieze, which not only has the fairs but runs a very important and highbrow art magazine called Frieze. And Endeavor bought a stake in the fair, and I think the plan was always to try to do something in Los Angeles. So they have formally announced their plans, and Angelina is directing the fair, Bettina Korek, who has been involved in a lot of artistic enterprises around Los Angeles, including a group called For Your Art. And the LA architect Kulapat Yantrasast of Y Architecture is going to be designing the structure, which is probably a really nice way of saying tent.
Well, okay, the bigger question is, do we need yet another art fair?
You know, if you ask me about art fairs, I will always say you never need an art fair, period, because they're just kind of awful places to see art. I don't care how nice they are. But
because of what? They're crowded and...
Well, I think, you know, it's very much about merchant. You know, you're in a market.
Yeah,
you're in a marketplace. It's about selling art. It's not necessarily about curating ideas. Often, especially in very big fairs like such as Basel and the Armory Show in New York, which I've spent a lot of time going to, you know, it's like the shiniest work wins. Like, this is not a quiet space in which to go contemplate the ideas an artist might be sharing. It's about buying and selling. And so for me, as somebody who does not cover art market, they're just not that interesting of places in which to maybe get exposed to new ideas. Like, I might cruise through to see what's happening, but usually by the fourth booth, like, my brain is full. And, you know, they're entering, it's, you know, LA has not had the best history with art fairs. Paris Photo and FIAC both gave up on their fairs here due to low sales. So, you know, whether Frieze is able to counter that turn of fairs coming in from the outside and trying to do things here, you know, is that going to work? Well, we'll see.
Yeah. Okay. Well, speaking of sort of a combination of museum and for sale, Hauser and Wirth has a Mark Bradford exhibition. We have about a few seconds left. Thumbs up, thumbs down, go see it.
Thumbs up, a really visceral collection of new paintings that feel very explosive, and a lot of them employing lots of old comic books in their construction, which he says is perfect for this time. It's like comics is civilization on steroids. Well, this political era is civilization on steroids.
Excellent. Okay, Caroline Miranda, she writes the Culture High and Low column for the LA Times, also a regular contributor here at Press Play. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.